To present the opposing point of view, we now have Senator Barry Goldwater.
Madam Chairwoman, Mr. Norman Thomas, and fellow Arizonans, this is a pleasure and an honor that I've looked forward to for a good many months. I have followed Mr. Thomas, I think, just about as long as he's been in politics, and while I started as a young man, I have always maintained a great admiration for him because of his sincerity and because of his very obvious honesty. These are hallmarks of Mr. Thomas, and I'm honored to be on the same platform with him here this evening. In fact, sir, I hope that when I reach the point of life that you have reached, that I will hold just a small modicum of the esteem in which you're held. And I also hope that as many of the things that I advocate in government will have been taken by that time, just as yours have been taken without your getting the credit for it. This was billed as a debate between conservatism and socialism, and I agree with Mr. Thomas that we couldn't possibly, in the time allotted us, get into it enough to come to any definite conclusions. I do suggest, though, that out of this discussion can come a better understanding of both of these philosophies. And I agree with Mr. Thomas that this has become a matter of confusion in the world of semantics. We don't know exactly what we mean when we say socialist or liberal or radical or conservative or Republican or Democrat. And being a practicing politician, I can tell you that the confusion is great. And I only hope to see the day when, by better education, more education, and better understanding, possibly we can come to a better alignment of the philosophies of this country. I'd start out by saying that, to avoid any argument in this field, that social reforms that have been accomplished in the past 30 to 35 years are with us, and they're going to remain. The thing that we conservatives want to do is to make them better where they're not working correctly by making them voluntary in nature. We realize that they cannot be repealed, or the chances of their being repealed are extremely remote. Therefore, we want to do what free men want to do every place, make our programs voluntary rather than compulsory. In fact, I was interested in reading again one of the many excellent writings of Mr. Thomas, in which he said, "More than once I have reminded myself, and occasionally audiences, that if I had been told that within a little over a generation, so many of the social reforms in which I, a young and ardent church and social worker, believed had been achieved or begun, I should have thought the millennium definitely attainable." And then he went on to add in the very next sentence, "Instead, I write as one concerned for human survival." Now, Mr. Thomas, so do I, as a conservative, speak and write for my interest and concern about human survival in this day and age. But I suggest that we have always been concerned with this, that this isn't new, that the weapons to bring about our destruction are greater today than they ever have been, but man is still our basic problem. And I think the conservative approach to the problems of the world and the country, in which they recognize that human nature plays the overriding role, is a safer one than starting off in some area that doesn't recognize the existence of man as a source of trouble. Now, what is a conservative? And here, again, as I said at the outset, is a field of great misunderstanding, just as we'll find in exploring a little later the misunderstanding in the field of socialism and liberalism. Well, a conservative, at least the conservatism that I believe in, believes in making our progress upon the proven values of the past. We can look back in history and we can find similar experiences that man has been subjected to in the past, and we know how he reacted. And when he's subjected to those experiences today, he's going to react in precisely the same way. So man is our problem, and we study history. We don't want to go back to history. I don't want to go back to this morning, as delightful as it was. I always have the memories. I just want to make progress for tomorrow by applying what I've learned today and in the yesterday so that the progress will be complete. Now, what is socialism? Well, here again, we get into real confusion. In fact, with all due deference to Mr. Thomas, I feel that after reading his book today, that he could conduct a pretty good debate with himself as to just what socialism is. And certainly in this world today, we find many different answers, and this is confusing. In fact, a pamphlet, and I don't even know how old it is, of the Socialist Labor Party in this country, makes a flat statement. The fact is that socialism has never been established in any country on earth. The phony socialists of Great Britain, with the blessing of the capitalists, gave the workers nationalization, not socialism. Now, there's confusion even amongst the ranks. How do they expect those of us who stand outside the hallowed halls to know what's going on within? According to an article written in the magazine USSR of August of this year by a Dr. Stepanian of Moscow, he claims that socialism is merely the step to communism. I don't necessarily buy this if we apply the philosophy that I believe Mr. Thomas carries. But he says in describing socialism that it's from each according to his ability to each according to his work. But when they move up into communism, it becomes from each according to his ability to each according to his need. Now, I might suggest that to achieve either one of these situations, whether you're operating under socialism as a Russian sees it or communism as a Russian sees it, we have to have public ownership of the means of production. Now, I find that in the American socialist movement, there's a great disagreement here. There's a disagreement in the words of Mr. Thomas as to how far we go in taking over public ownership of all means of production. In his book, I gather that it wouldn't be complete, that we would control the major sources of production, probably power, steel, the automobiles, and so forth, and so on. But to do this requires one thing, and I want to impress you with this if I can. No matter what we call a form of government foreign to ours or an economic system foreign to ours, it can be a monarchy, it could be egalitarianism, it could be the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the New Frontier, socialism, communism, I don't care what you want to call it, you have to have central control in order to make it work. Now, I suspect that the word central control is confusing to the American socialists because I think they recognize, better than their brethren around the world, that central control has historically ruined freedom or destroyed freedom wherever it's been tried. Now, here again, we get into a little difference of opinion. The Socialist Labor Party, for example, denies that the government should operate all of the means of production. They say, and I quote them, socialist government will rest on industrial democracy. Well, that's kind of hard for me to fathom. What is industrial democracy? Where does the government fit in? If they say that they can operate these plants without government intervention, I can't quite understand how it will come about unless this is brought on by an open revolution. Here again, the Russian, speaking of socialism, claims that these are inalienable rights, and they're material rights. The right to a job, the right to rest and leisure, to free education, to free medical service, to maintenance in old age and disability. Now, we do not hold that. In America, we hold that our inalienable rights are rights that were given to us by God, and that these things that are mentioned here, at their best, are civil liberties. They're the liberties that the people have the right to achieve if they're able to, and if they are unable to, and if their brothers refuse, then I have to say as a conservative that the only source of relief for these unfortunate people will be government at some level. I would prefer it at a local level, at a county level, or a state level, but resist the federal level as long and as strongly as we can. This is one of the major differences in the arguments that continually crop up between our type of freedom and the freedom that the socialist divisions, namely that we look upon the right of doing this, the freedom of assembly, the freedom of speech, the freedom of religion, the freedom to seek property and hold property as being the important rights, the rights that have come to us by the endowment from God. We don't look on these others that the Russian socialist looks on as inalienable rights. We look upon them as attainable liberties if we desire to do so. Now, in this world today, and again we get confusing, who is it that's advocating socialism? Well, I clipped out of a paper the other day a little statement with the dateline Tokyo, in which Mr. Mao said, and I quote him, "The Chinese people will spare no effort to continue to work untiringly for the strengthening of the unity of the peoples of China and the Soviet Union and for the strengthening of the unity of the socialist camp." Now, what kind of socialism are they talking about? Is it the socialism that Mr. Thomas has advocated throughout his life? And then we read something that was written by a young gentleman in Washington by the name of Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. This is a number of years ago, but there's been no retraction. "There seems no inherent obstacle to the gradual advance of socialism in the United States through a series of new deals." Now, what are these two socialisms? Can they be the same? Mr. Thomas states very definitely in his book that it's easy to prove that Russia is not socialistic, but on the other hand, they claim it as part of their Marxist heritage. And in Schlesinger's remarks, I detect, although there's nothing definite said, that he's talking of the cooperative type of program that we would link with socialism because it would have to have central planning. So we have these two types of socialism, at least two, probably more. One is complete, and this is the one that I believe the Russian and the Chinese have adopted, the one that I believe communism believes in. The other is partial, and I think this is the type of socialism that Mr. Thomas advocates. Now, the question is, how do we keep it partial? How do we be part socialist and not wind up being all the way socialist? And I say that for this reason. In reading Mr. Thomas's book and his other writings, I detect a constant fear of capitalism. And had I been engaged in business at the same time that he was emerging, you might say, in the United States, I possibly would have had a fear of capitalism too. But I feel that capitalism has changed, that it is not the ugly ogre that it once was. But the thing that made it the ugly ogre was not capitalism per se. It was, again, man. When man wanted to be stingy, when man wanted to get profit, regardless of what he did to other people, then the capitalist system worked at its worst. But how are we going to prevent this same man? And remember, we're all the animal man. And when I say that, I include you ladies. So don't think I'm not looking on you as potential sources of problems. History will bear me down on that. As long as man will have the bad side of his nature up, then I suggest that anything that we might get into in the way of political or economic philosophy will fail. If we don't recognize this, and if we feel that, well, this hasn't worked, so we've got to try this, and this means central control, and the exposing of all of the people to the whims and desire of power of a few, then we're going to wind up in the same problem that we found ourselves in around the turn of the century, when capitalism had to, by law, be stopped in its drive for power. This drive and desire for power, unfortunately, is probably the root trouble in human beings and in the nature of man. Now, I would say as a conservative that if we take on socialism in this country, or even partially take it on to a greater extent than we have now done it, would be to deny forever the good that capitalism has brought in this country. And I'm not one who's ashamed of capitalism. I'm not one who's ashamed of profit as a reward for initiative and ambition and hard work. The first real test that our systems came to since the Civil War came in the early 30s when we were part of a worldwide depression. And I might say that here Mr. Thomas and I agree that the government action that was attempted in the 30s was not successful. It took World War II to get us out of that depression. And Mr. Thomas, you and I are not alone there. We're backed up by Professor John Galbraith of Harvard, who makes the same declaration in a book he wrote back about 1953. Today, we're denying our economic system its full expression. The economy is not growing at the rate that it should grow. The trouble rests in the tax system. It rests in the fact that other nations allow a more rapid write-off of new equipment. And here we find ourselves in the fourth quarter of this year with capital investment lower than in 1957 and only a few percentage points above last year. If we're going to make jobs for the 2.5 million people that need them coming up every year, capital has to be invested. Not the capital that's taken from you in the form of taxes and invested by government, but capital that is earned by the sweat of man and by the use of man's hands and his ingenuity. If we do this, I have the honest conviction that we would have a manpower shortage in this country within a matter of months, and that all of the economic and worldwide problems related to economics that Mr. Thomas and his socialist friends see would be put in flight. I, as a conservative, constantly say that we ought to let the Constitution use its very, very flexible self upon the political problems of America today, and that we ought to let our economic processes work, not pull back at the first sign of trouble and say, oh, we have to turn to the federal government in order to have these problems solved. I think we all recognize today, as we've always recognized, I might say, since the writing of the Constitution, that there is a role for government in the control of our business. There is a role in the control of money, and that we can readily recognize the times when people resisted these controls, but they don't anymore, except where they are overdone to the point that freedom itself is challenged. No, I'll close by saying in this opening part of my remarks that to me, the whole problem that faces us domestically and internationally is no different today than it was 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago, or 10,000 years ago, is to keep the good side of man up. Now, if there's some way, through legislation or education, that we could change human nature, then we wouldn't have any problems in this world at all. We could talk about peaceful coexistence because man recognizes these evil things, but man is a weak individual. And that's why I believe that man should depend upon God for his guidance and his strength. It should depend upon himself. But most importantly, we as people should be concerned with other people as our brother's keepers, not concerned with a mighty government who wants to do this job for us. Once we succumb to the siren song of the government doing it for us, then I'm afraid we will have gone past the point of return, and we can become another nation, another civilization in the history of the world that had a real good chance, but we didn't allow our strengths the opportunity to work when the strengths could be applied. Thank you very much.